Good evening. Welcome to the bookshelf. This is Mike Ailman. Count Leo Nikolaevich Tolstoy was born to an aristocratic Russian family on September 9, 1828. In 1844, he entered the University of Kazan, remaining there only 3 years. At the age of 23, Tolstoy joined the Russian army and fought in the Crimean War. Tolstoy returned to his estate in 1861 and established a school for peasant children there. The death of Ivan Ilyich, published in 1885, is amazingly contemporary, a timeless classic of the human condition. In the death of Ivan Ilyich, Tolstoy takes what was for him a tremendous imaginary leap of analyzing the reactions of a man who, until the surprising pain of his terminal illness began, had never given the inevitability of his own dying so much as a passing thought. The Death of Ivan Ilyich. Chapter 1. In the large building housing the law courts, during a recess in the Melvinsky proceedings, members of the court and the public prosecutor met in the office of Ivan Igorovich Shebek, where the conversation turned on the celebrated Krasov case. Fyodor Vasilyevich vehemently denied that it was subject to their jurisdiction. Ivan Igorovich clung to his own view, while Pyotr Ivanovich, who had taken no part in the dispute from the outset, glanced through a copy of the news that had just been delivered. "Gentlemen," he said, "Ivan Ilyich is dead." "Really? Here, read this," he said to Fyodor Vasilyevich, handing him the fresh issue, still smelling of printer's ink. Framed in black was the following announcement: "With profound sorrow, Praskovya Fyodorovna Golovina informs relatives and acquaintances that her beloved husband, Ivan Ilyich Golovin, member of the Court of Justice, passed away on the 4th of February, 1882. The funeral will be held Friday at 1 o'clock. Ivan Ilyich had been a colleague of the gentlemen assembled there, and they had all been fond of him. He had been ill for some weeks, and his disease was said to be incurable. His post had been kept open for him, but it had been speculated that in the event of his death, Alexeyev might be appointed to his place, and either Vinnikov or Stabel succeeded Alexeyev. And so the first thought that occurred to each of the gentlemen in this office, learning of Ivan Ilyich's death, was what effect it would have on their own transfers and promotions, or those of their acquaintances. Now I am sure to get Stabel's post or Vinnikov's, thought Fyodor Vasilyevich. It was promised to me long ago, and the promotion will mean an increase of 800 rubles in salary, plus an allowance for office expenses. I must put in a request to have my brother-in-law transferred from Kaluga, thought Pyotr Ivanovich. My wife will be very happy. Now she won't be able to say I never do anything for her. I had a feeling he'd never get over it, said Pyotr Ivanovich. Sad. What exactly was the matter with him? The doctors couldn't decide. That is, they decided, but in different ways. When I saw him, I thought he would recover. And I haven't been there since the holidays. I kept meaning to go. Was he a man of any means? His wife has a little something, I think, but nothing much. Well, there's no question that we will have to go and see her. They live so terribly far away. From you, that is. From your place, everything's far away. You see, he just can't forgive me for living on the other side of the river, said Pyotr Ivanovich, smiling at Shebek. With that, they began talking about relative distances in town and went back to the courtroom. In addition to the speculations aroused in each man's mind about the transfers and likely job changes this death might occasion, the very fact of the death of a close acquaintance evoked in them all the usual feeling of relief that it was someone else, not they, who had died. Well, isn't that something? He's dead, but I'm not, was what each of them thought or felt. The closer acquaintances, the so-called friends of Ivan Ilyich, involuntarily added to themselves that now they had to fulfill the tedious demands of propriety by attending the funeral service and paying the widow a condolence call. Fyodor Vasilyevich and Pyotr Ivanovich had been closest to him. Pyotr Ivanovich had studied law with Ivan Ilyich and considered himself indebted to him. At dinner that evening, he told his wife the news of Ivan Ilyich's death, conjectured about the possibility of having her brother transferred to their district, and then, dispensing with his usual nap, he put on a dress coat and drove to Ivan Ilyich's home. A carriage and two cabs were parked before the entrance. Downstairs in the hallway next to the coat stand, a coffin lid decorated with silk brocade, tassels, and highly polished gilt braid was propped against the wall. Two women in black were taking off their fur coats. One of them he recognized as Ivan Ilyich's sister. The other was a stranger. Schwartz, his colleague, was just starting down the stairs, but on seeing Pyotr Ivanovich enter, he paused at the top step and winked at him as if to say, "Ivan Ilyich has really bungled. Not the sort of thing you and I would do." There was, as usual, an air of elegant solemnity about Schwartz, with his English side whiskers and his lean figure in a dress coat. And this solemnity, always such a marked contrast to his playful personality, had a special piquancy here. So, at least, Pyotr Ivanovich thought. Pyotr Ivanovich stepped aside to let the ladies pass and slowly followed them up the stairs. Schwartz did not proceed downward, but remained on the landing. Pyotr Ivanovich understood why. Obviously, he wanted to arrange where they should play whist that evening. The ladies went upstairs to the widow's quarters, while Schwartz, his lips compressed into a serious expression and his eyes gleaming playfully, jerked his brows to the right to indicate the room where the dead man lay. Pyotr Ivanovich went in bewildered, as people invariably are, about what he was expected to do there. The one thing he knew was that on such occasions it never did any harm to cross oneself. He was not quite certain whether he ought also to bow, and so he adopted a middle course. On entering the room, he began to cross himself and make a slight movement resembling a bow. At the same time, to the extent that the motions of his hands and head permitted, he glanced about the room. Two young people, apparently nephews, one of them a gymnasium student, were crossing themselves as they left the room. An old woman was standing motionless, and a lady with peculiarly arched brows was whispering something to her. A church reader in a frock coat, a vigorous, resolute fellow, was reading something in a loud voice and in a tone that brooked no contradiction. The pantry boy, Gerasim, stepped lightly in front of Pyotr Ivanovich, sprinkling something about the floor. Seeing this, Pyotr Ivanovich immediately became aware of a faint odor of decomposition. On his last visit, Pyotr Ivanovich had seen this peasant boy in Ivan Ilyich's study. He had acted as a sick nurse to the dying man, and Ivan Ilyich had been particularly fond of him. Pyotr Ivanovich went on crossing himself and bowing slightly in a direction midway between the coffin, the church reader, the icons on the table in the corner. Then, when he felt he had overdone the crossing, he paused and began to examine the dead. The body lay, as the dead invariably do, in a peculiarly heavy manner, with its rigid limbs sunk into the bedding of the coffin, and its head eternally bowed on the pillow, exhibiting, as do all dead bodies, a yellow waxen forehead, with bald patches gleaming on the sunken temples, the protruding nose beneath seeming to press down against the upper lip. Ivan Ilyich had changed a great deal, grown even thinner since Pyotr Ivanovich had seen him last, and yet, as with all dead men, his face had acquired an expression of greater beauty, above all, a greater significance than it had in life. Its expression implied that what needed to be done had been done, and done properly. Moreover, there was in this expression a reproach or a reminder to the living. This reminder seemed out of place to Pyotr Ivanovich, or at least inapplicable to him. He began to feel somewhat uncomfortable, and so he crossed himself hurriedly, all too hurriedly, he felt, from the standpoint of propriety, turned and headed for the door. In the adjoining room, Schwartz was waiting for him, his feet planted solidly apart, his hands toying with the top hat that he held behind his back. One glance at his playful, well-groomed, elegant figure was enough to revive Pyotr Ivanovich. He felt that Schwartz was above all this and would not succumb to mournful impressions. His very appearance seemed to say, In no way can the incident of this funeral service for Ivan Ilyich be considered sufficient grounds for canceling the regular session. That is, nothing can prevent us from meeting tonight and flipping through a new deck of cards while a footman places four fresh candles around the table. There is, in fact, no reason to assume this incident can keep us from spending a pleasant evening. And he said as much to Pyotr Ivanovich in a whisper, proposing they meet for a game at Fyodor Vasilyevich's. But Pyotr Ivanovich was not destined to play cards that evening. Praskovya Fyodorovna, a short, stocky woman, far broader at the hips than at the shoulders, despite all her efforts to the contrary, dressed in all black with a lace shawl on her head and the same peculiarly arched brows as the women facing the coffin, emerged from her chambers with some other ladies, whom she showed to the door of the room where the dead man lay, and said, "The service is about to begin. Do go in." Schwartz made a vague sort of bow, and then stopped, neither accepting nor rejecting the invitation. Recognizing Pyotr Ivanovich, Praskovya Fyodorovna sighed, went right up to him, took his hand, and said, "I know you are a true friend of Ivan Ilyich's," and looked at him, awaiting a fitting response. Pyotr Ivanovich knew that just as he had to cross himself in there, here he had to press her hand, sigh, and say, "I assure you." And so he did. And having done so, felt he had achieved the desired effect. He was touched, and so was she. "Come, before it begins, I must have a talk with you," said the widow. "Give me your arm." He gave her his arm, and they proceeded toward the inner rooms, past Schwartz, who threw Pyotr Ivanovich a wink of regret that said, "So much for your card game. Don't be offended if we find another player. Perhaps you can make a fifth when you get away." Pyotr Ivanovich sighed even more deeply and plaintively, and Praskovya Fyodorovna squeezed his hand gratefully. On entering her drawing room, decorated in pink cretonne and lit with a dim lamp, they sat down beside a table, she on a sofa, Pyotr Ivanovich on a low ottoman with broken springs that shifted under his weight. Praskovya Fyodorovna wanted to warn him against sitting there, but felt such a warning was not in keeping with her situation, and decided against it. As he sat down on the ottoman, Pyotr Ivanovich recalled how, in decorating the room, Ivan Ilyich had consulted him about this pink cretonne with the green leaves. The whole room was crammed with furniture and knick-knacks. As the widow stepped past the table to seat herself on the sofa, she entangled the lace of her black shawl in a bit of carving. Pyotr Ivanovich rose slightly to untangle it, and as he did, the springs of the ottoman, freed of pressure, surged and gave him a little shove. The widow started to disentangle the lace herself, and Pyotr Ivanovich sat down again, suppressing the rebellious springs beneath him. But the widow had not fully disengaged herself, and Pyotr Ivanovich rose again, and again the ottoman rebelled and even creaked. When all this was over, the widow took out a clean cambric handkerchief and began to weep. The episode with the lace and the battle with the ottoman had chilled Pyotr Ivanovich's emotions, and he sat there, scowling. The strain of the situation was broken when Sokolov, Ivan Ilyich's footman, came to report that the plot Praskovya Fyodorovna had selected in the cemetery would cost 200 rubles. She stopped weeping and, glancing at Pyotr Ivanovich with a victimized air, told him in French how hard this was for her. He responded with a silent gesture, indicating he had no doubt that this was so. "Please feel free to smoke," she said, in a magnanimous yet crushed tone of voice, and turned to Sokolov to discuss the price of the grave. As he lit his cigarette, Pyotr Ivanovich heard her make detailed inquiries about the prices of various plots and arrive at a very sound decision. Moreover, when she had settled that matter, she made arrangements about the choristers. Then Sokolov left. "I attend to everything myself," she said to Pyotr Ivanovich, moving aside some albums on the table. and noticing that the ashes of his cigarette were in danger of falling on the table, she quickly passed him an ashtray and said, "I believe it would be sheer pretense for me to say that I am unable, because of grief, to attend to practical matters. On the contrary, if anything can, I won't say console, but distract me, it is seeing to all these things about him." Again, she shook out a handkerchief as if about to weep, but suddenly seemed to have mastered her emotion, and with a little toss of her head, she began to speak calmly. "But there is a matter I wish to discuss with you." Pyotr Ivanovich bowed his head in response, taking care not to allow the springs of the ottoman, which immediately grew restive, to have their way. "He suffered terribly the last few days." "Did he?" asked Pyotr Ivanovich. "Oh, frightfully! He screamed incessantly, not for minutes, but for hours on end. He screamed for 3 straight days without pausing for breath. It was unbearable. I don't know how I bore up through it all. You could hear him 3 rooms away. Oh, what I've been through." "And was he really conscious through it all?" asked Pyotr Ivanovich. "Yes," she whispered, "to the very last. He took leave of us 1/4 hour before he died, and even asked us to take Volodya away." Despite a distasteful awareness of his own hypocrisy as well as hers, Pyotr Ivanovich was overcome with horror as he thought of the suffering of someone he had known so well, first as a carefree boy, then as a schoolmate, later as a grown man, his colleague. Once again he saw that forehead, that nose pressing down on the upper lip, and fear for himself took possession of him. 3 days of terrible suffering and death, why, the same thing could happen to me at any time now, he thought, and for a moment felt panic-stricken. But at once he himself did not know how. He was rescued by the customary reflection that all this had happened to Ivan Ilyich, not to him, that it could not and should not happen to him, and that if he were to grant such a possibility, he would succumb to depression which, as Schwartz's expression had made abundantly clear, he ought not to do. With this line of reasoning, Pyotr Ivanovich set his mind at rest and began to press for details about Ivan Ilyich's death, as though death were a chance experience that could happen only to Ivan Ilyich, never to himself. After giving him various details about the truly horrible physical suffering Ivan Ilyich had endured, details which Pyotr Ivanovich learned strictly in terms of their unnerving effect on Praskovya Fyodorovna, the widow evidently felt it necessary to get down to business. "Ah, Pyotr Ivanovich, how hard it is, how terribly, terribly hard," she said, and again began weeping. Pyotr Ivanovich sighed and waited for her to blow her nose. When she had, he said, "I assure you," and again she began to talk freely to get down to what was obviously her chief business with him, to ask how, in connection with her husband's death, she could obtain a grant of money from the government. She made it appear that she was asking Pyotr Ivanovich's advice about a pension, but he saw that she already knew more about this than he did, knew exactly, down to the finest detail, how much could be had from the government, but wanted to know if there was any possibility of extracting a bit more. Pyotr Ivanovich tried to think of some means of doing so, but after giving the matter a little thought and, for the sake of propriety, condemning the government for its stinginess, said he thought no more could be had. Whereupon she sighed and evidently tried to find some pretext for getting rid of her visitor. He surmised as much, put out his cigarette, stood up, shook her hand, and went out into the hall. In the dining room, with the clock which Ivan Ilyich had been so happy to have purchased at an antique shop, Pyotr Ivanovich met a priest and a few acquaintances who had come for the service, and he caught sight of a handsome young woman, Ivan Ilyich's daughter. She was dressed all in black, which made her slender waist appear even more so. She had a gloomy, determined, almost angry expression, and bowed to Pyotr Ivanovich as if he were to blame for something. Behind her, with the same offended look, stood a rich young man Pyotr Ivanovich knew, an examining magistrate who, he had heard, was her fiancé. Pyotr Ivanovich gave them a mournful bow and was about to enter the dead man's room when Ivan Ilyich's son, a schoolboy who had an uncanny resemblance to his father, appeared from behind the stairwell. He was a small replica of Ivan Ilyich, whom Pyotr Ivanovich remembered from law school. His eyes were red from crying and had the look common to boys of 13 or 14, whose thoughts are no longer innocent. Seeing Pyotr Ivanovich, he frowned in a shamefaced way. Pyotr Ivanovich nodded to him and entered the room where the body lay. The service began. Candles, groans, incense, tears, sobs. Pyotr Ivanovich stood with his brows knitted, staring at the feet of the people in front of him. Never once did he look at the dead man or succumb to depression, and he was one of the first to leave. There was no one in the hallway but Gerasim, the pantry boy. Darted out of the dead man's room, rummaged with his strong hands through the mound of fur coats to find Pyotr Ivanovich's and helped him on with it. "Well, Gerasim, my boy," said Pyotr Ivanovich in order to say something. "It's sad, isn't it?" "It's God's will, sir. We all have to die someday," said Gerasim, displaying an even row of healthy white peasant teeth. And then, like a man in the thick of work, he briskly opened the door, shouted to the coachman, seated Pyotr Ivanovich in the carriage, and sprang back up the porch steps as though wondering what to do next. After the smell of incense, the corpse, and the carbolic acid, Pyotr Ivanovich found it particularly pleasant to breathe in the fresh air. "Where to, sir?" asked the coachman. "It's not that late," and when he arrived, he found they were just finishing the first rubber, so that it was convenient for him to make a fifth for the next. Chapter 2. Ivan Ilyich's life had been most simple and commonplace, and most horrifying. He died at the age of 45, a member of the Court of Justice. He was the son of an official who, in various Petersburg ministries and departments, had established a sort of career whereby men reach a stage at which, owing to their rank and years of service, they cannot be dismissed, even though they are clearly unfit for any responsible work. And therefore, they receive fictitious appointments, especially designed for them, and by no means fictitious salaries, of from 6 to 10,000, on which they live to a ripe old age. Such was the Privy Councillor Ilya Efimovich Golovin, superfluous member of various superfluous institutions. He had three sons, of whom Ivan Ilyich was the second. The eldest had established the same type of career as his father, except in a different ministry, and was rapidly approaching the stage where men obtained sinecures. The third son was a failure. He had ruined his prospects in a number of positions and was now serving in the railway division. His father and brothers, and especially their wives, not only hated meeting him, but unless compelled to do otherwise, managed to forget his existence. The sister had married Baron Greff, the same sort of Petersburg official as his father-in-law, Ivan Ilyich. He was neither as cold and punctilious as his elder brother, nor as reckless as his younger. He was a happy man between the two, a clever, lively, pleasant, and respectable man. He and his younger brother had both attended the School of Jurisprudence. The younger brother never graduated, for he was expelled when he reached the fifth course. On the other hand, Ivan Ilyich completed the program credibly. As a law student, he had become exactly what he was to remain the rest of his life, a capable, cheerful, good-natured, and sociable man, but one strict to carry out whatever he considered his duty, and he considered his duty all things that were so designated by people in authority. Neither as a boy nor as an adult had he been a toady, but from his earliest youth, he had been drawn to people of high standing in society as a moth is to light. He had adopted their manners and their views on life and had established friendly relations with them. All the enthusiasms of childhood and youth passed, leaving no appreciable impact on him. He had succumbed to sensuality and vanity, and in the last years at school, to liberalism, but strictly within the limits his instinct unerringly prescribed. As a student, he had done things which at the time seemed to him extremely vile and made him feel disgusted with himself. But later, seeing that people of high standing had no qualms about doing these things, he was not quite able to consider them good, but managed to dismiss them and not feel the least perturbed when he recalled them. When he graduated from law school with a degree qualifying him for the 10th rank of civil service and had obtained money from his father for his outfit, he ordered some suits at Sharmer's, the fashionable tailor, hung a medallion inscribed Respice Finem on his watch chain, took leave of his mentor and prince, who was patron of the school, dined in state with his friends at Donan's, and then with fashionable new luggage, linen, clothes, shaving and other toilet articles, and a traveling rug, all ordered and purchased at the finest shops, he set off for one of the provinces to assume a post his father had secured for him there as assistant on special commissions to the governor. Ivan Ilyich immediately made his life in the provinces as easy and pleasant as it had been at law school. He worked, saw to his career, and at the same time engaged in proper and pleasant forms of diversion. When from time to time he traveled to country districts on official business, he maintained his dignity with both his superiors and inferiors, and fulfilled the duties entrusted to him, primarily cases involving a group of religious sectarians, with an exactitude and incorruptibility in which he could only take pride. In his official duties, despite his youth and love of light forms of amusement, he was exceedingly reserved, punctilious, and even severe. But in society he was often playful and witty, always good-humored and polite, and a bon enfant, as the governor and his wife, with whom he was like one of the family, used to say to him. In the provinces, he had an affair with one of the ladies who threw themselves at the chick young lawyer. There was also a milliner. There were drinking bouts with visiting aides-de-camp and after-supper trips to a certain street on the outskirts of town. There were also attempts to curry favor with the chief and even with the chief's wife. But all this had such a heightened air of respectability that nothing bad could be said about it. It could all be summed up by the French saying, "Il faut que jeunesse se passe." It was all done with clean hands in clean shirts, and with French phrases, and most importantly, among people of the best society, consequently, with the approval of those in high rank. You've been listening to Count Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich. This is Mike Aylman. Thanks for listening, and good night from the bookshelf.